Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So, sir, thanks for coming along tonight, where Karen McCartney makes her first appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce her briefly. She has an honours degree in history and art and English at the University College in London. She's written for L Decoration, for the Financial Times and the World of Interiors. She's edited Miraclay Lifestyle and Inside Out, and she's currently an editorial consultant to online brands. And she's here on the occasion of the publication of the paperback edition of her book, 50, 60, 70, Iconic Australian Houses. And of course, after that, there was the book, 70, 80, 90, Australian Iconic Houses. And the topic for tonight's discussion is Australian Iconic Houses. Karen McCarthy, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for coming. I really appreciate having this wonderful turnout. I feel very privileged that you're all here to listen to this topic. Now, iconic Australian houses, the word iconic has become quite overused, overpeddled, and so people often say, are your houses really iconic? And I get a bit on the back foot and I say, well, actually, I chose these houses because of what I could find in Australia and what I could photograph in Australia. So I don't put this selection up as the definitive selection of Australian iconic houses. There are others. I couldn't find them, and if I could find them, I couldn't get into them, because sometimes you find a wonderful house with a less than wonderful owner. And you can negotiate all you like, but at the end of the day, if they don't want you in their home, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. Also, I tried to be true to the period, so I didn't really want to photograph a beautiful 60s house that was timber and brick that had a great big floral sofa in it. I wanted to try and have some authenticity around the furnishings and so forth at the same time. And what we undertook that was different, and I preface this by saying, because I was a magazine editor, I'm great at coming up with ideas, usually that other people do. And in this instance, this was an idea that was accepted by the publisher, that then they said, okay, off you go. And I did have a moment of panic of thinking, you know, how am I going to find these places? So what I want to take you through today are a number of houses that I believe to be iconic. I think I got a great selection of Australian architects. And the book was inspired by Bruce Rickard, who unfortunately died a couple of years ago. But Bruce built the house that we live in and have lived in for 14 years. And I fell in love with the house emotionally before knowing anything about it intellectually, which is always really the best way, I think. I came to Australia in 98 not knowing anything about Australian architects and not knowing anything much about architecture. I knew lots about interiors and light fittings and so forth, but architecture was a whole new topic for me. So I think we should just get into, I've got lots of examples. I've got half an hour, and then we've got lots of time for questions, and we can go back and we can look at things in the book and you know, explore the topic more broadly as you see fit. This is one of the first houses that I did put in my proposal. It was built for a naturist, a single man, who approached Neville Grusman to build this house on this wonderful, wonderful site. And Grusman created a great deal of landscaping. He created hills so that the approach to the house becomes very private, both, you know, visually private, orally private. He you can see on the left there is a waterfall. So once you're in this space, it was very, very contained. At the time, it was the interior was done by Marion Hall Best, a very famous Australian interior decorator. And to me, it looks great with this wonderful neutral concrete palette. But apparently at the time, it had red carpet and leopard skin sofas. So it would have been quite a radical experience, you know, in the bush to come across this incredibly modern house with this structurally fascinating staircase and with integrated fireplace. I mean, I think even an engineer came in and said, I don't actually know how this is staying up. And the other thing he was pioneering in his approach to was you can just see, I don't know if this is, anyway, you can just see just here, this was originally a one-wall kitchen. So the new owners turned it into a bookcase, but it was a stainless steel kitchen. So there are lots of things we'll see in these houses that have just become commonplace today that we take for granted are part of our architectural visual language, but actually these young architects at the time pioneered. And actually the hills went back to Grusman, and he built in the 80s a huge extension on this house, and this now acts as a sort of foyer to the house rather than an area that they actually actively live in. Now, this is a house in Victoria in Rye, and McGlash and Everest were very experimental architects. One lived in Melbourne, one lived in Geelong, and they used to communicate by putting notes on the train and so forth. So it's a very interesting kind of dialogue how they actually work. But like the Grusman House, this had a very strong influence of Japan. And, you know, this was a period when young Australian architects started to travel and experience other cultures and then adapt them to an Australian way of life. So they didn't appropriate them wholesale. They kind of found ways that they could integrate the thinking rather than the actual visual expression. So this is an internal courtyard. It's quite windy there, so this was very protective. And also, you know, the timber lining, and David McGlashan designed the furniture. So there was the beginnings of this idea that you actually approached it as a holistic experience where both the furniture and the interior and the exterior were part of the same experience. Now, this is a very famous house, and I guess a lot of you will know this. And so I tried to, in the book, make choices between ones that people might be familiar with, like the Seidler House and so forth, and Murcutt, but then combine that with lesser-known houses to just show that variety. And we took a five-day holiday up to this area and visited Glenn when he was there running one of his master classes, and he took us through the house, and he's such a great storyteller and explains so much of the original, you know, the thinking around this, which partly came about by him being in Sydney, the client being, 7 hours drive north at that time. Mary Short had gathered a lot of hardwood timbers, and also they were using local workers. So he didn't want to overcomplicate the design. So this groundbreaking house kind of arose out of a set of circumstances, which was this kind of vernacular approach, but actually this incredibly modern plan. And I think that's what resonates so strongly. There's something that people recognise and are familiar with, but there's also something new and different about it. And to me, the biggest thing that was new and different was that Mary Short, part of the brief was that the house could be moved. It's between two bodies of water on a floodplain. And so Glenn designed these exposed bolts so that you could basically unbolt the house and move it. It never actually moved, but when he bought it, he unlocked it, added a middle section, and just extended the house. So in a way, his original design kind of played back to him in a really interesting way when it was his house. And here you can see the tremendous admiration for Scandinavian architecture with that really warm timber clad. The furniture is all from is all Nordic. It's Aalto and Arne Jacobsen. And then Glenn also designed this fireplace, this, you know, tremendous steel, this beautiful deep red colour. And when we went to see him, he said, you know, I failed sun and sun control when I was at university, sun and shade, and how he then went on to develop these louvers, which are so important in his work, this idea of orientation for maximum winter light and so forth, but then how light is managed through the louvers. And the house is very, very beautiful, very warm, feels generous, but also cocooning at the same time. Now, we're going to leap a bit, because the exhibition at the Museum of Sydney is based on the two books. The first book was written in 2007. All the houses were shot for the book. And the second book was in 2011, and again, they were all shot for the book. So when we came to designing an exhibition, which I'd never done before and found, kind of slightly intimidating, we looked at, is it chronological or is there another way to approach the content? And what we came up with was a number of themes, such as materials, landscape, sculptural buildings. And this was a way to kind of create, to pull houses together across the decades so that you could see this great continuity in Australian architecture that wasn't about just this happened in this period and this in another period. So in our materials section, Sean Godsell was very interesting because he has used, this is his own house, and I have gone to quite a few architects' own properties, and that's because A, they're in good condition, and they've, I think Robin Boyd said in the 50s, there's no other place that an architect can find full expression of their own ideas if they can't do it basically in their own home. And here Sean Godsell has used these gridded walkways that has then been rusted, and they form this sort of, so it's a very simple pavilion style house, but then it's the rusted walkways that give it its sort of a more elemental kind of character. And you can see how the light effects come through. And also he was very influenced by Japan, and you can see the line there in the timber floor where panels could come across and you could divide space. So he said it was a great house when his son was very little, less good when he was a teenager. So you can imagine that kind of division of space changes as your life needs kind of change. But if you're the son of an architect, I guess you just accept it. This is one of my favourite houses, the Grounds House of 54. So Sir Roy Grounds built this house. It was when Melbourne was kind of obsessed with geometry in the post-war period. And this is basically a circle within a square, and the living space is the bit in between. So I reckon even today it would be considered a very radical way to live. Again, there are very few divisions. There's very little privacy. The house kind of just continues around. There you can see how you look into the courtyard. So it means that nature is always a part of every view that you have within the house. And we interviewed the guy, Martin Hiscock, who renovated this house. It was quite derelict when he took it on, and he renovated it to the degree that this tabletop is black marble that came from Italy, and it was originally designed to be heated. And the first one he got to the exact proportions was cracked on its way over, so we had to then get a second one. And he had to source imperial measurements of the cork tile. So, he was incredibly detailed and specific about, getting the right thing. And then, interestingly enough, he sold it a few years later. And it sort of felt to me that this would be a life's work that you would want to live with. So I find it interesting that he was happy to do that and then pass it on to someone else. But it's beautifully preserved and restored. And this is Robin Boyd's Wall Street house, which, couldn't be more different in a way in philosophy to the Grounds house, because its inventiveness is just staggering, but also in a more makeshift way. He's used these steel cables, which you can sort of see here, and onto that he has set timber planks that are then, I think, bitumened, but that is the supporting roof right from the high point down to the low point at the very back. And he put the kids down in this zone at the back after one particularly noisy summer holidays. He changed his design to give the kids this separate area right at the back of the courtyard. And Peter McIntyre, who's another Melbourne architect who is still alive, and I interviewed him, said that he had been at a party and he looked up to see this platform wobbling very precariously, and they had to get half the guests back in because it was all looking a bit dodgy. And they said, oh, Robin never worried too much about what engineers said. They thought they over-engineered things, so clearly he might have paid a bit more attention. But they also, Robin and his wife, used this main living room as their bedroom. So by night it was a bedroom, by day it became a living room. So their friends thought that this was quite, you know, ridiculous. But the way they thought about space and used space was very unconventional, you know, at the time. And this is the downstairs kitchen dining, which then links with this huge window wall to the courtyard. So, you know, this was a tiny subdivision. It was a rose garden of an adjacent property. And it was just how much he made of the small space and how much nature was integrated back into the house. And this is one of the things that comes through time and time again. If you think of 40s houses, which had a more colonial model, you know, there was little connection to outdoors. And these houses all really, you know, that thing we all want today is that connection to outdoors. And this is where it really began. Peter Muller is a very interesting architect who has had a very varied life. But this was the house that he did when he was a very young man. And it's easy to see this house just driving along Edinburgh Road in Castlecrag. He designed it for Bob Audette, who was an American car dealer, and Peter Muller had won a scholarship, and he'd been to America. So when Bob Audette wanted a house, they thought, "Oh, go to that young guy who's been to America," and they wanted a colonial style house. And the story is really wonderful that Peter actually made a model, and he had a tiny, I suppose a tiny flat apartment in King's Cross, and he just left the model there, went out saying he was going to get some cigarettes, and left them with it. And when he came back, they said yes. So he said he didn't try and persuade them or talk them out of what they wanted. But to this day, and I suspect he's now in his late 70s or early 80s, he regrets. Bob Audette went out and found these, what Peter thinks are very ugly wire cut bricks. And because you know, materials were so scarce at that point, bought them. And Peter had always imagined this in sandstone in a much more, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright style. And to this day, he can't bear those bloody bricks. You know, it drives him insane. So what he developed was a most unattractive sounding snotted brickwork, where they're pushed down so that you get this extrusion. And he just was desperate to create some character in what was a very, he felt, dull and uninspiring brickwork. And obviously he is influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright, but he maintains it even more so. He's influenced by music and rhythm, and you know, you get these wonderful repetitions in his work that make him such an interesting architect. Now, this is my house. So this is what started the whole thing off. We bought this house in 2000. The Marshalls had commissioned Bruce Rickard, and they had lived in it for 33 years. So it had really only had one previous owner. And Bruce was very passionate about landscape and native landscape and setting everything properly, you know, in a context. And this is it's a battle axe block, so you go down a very steep drive. But then it's incredibly private because it's set along the length of the block. And it's never been so tidy as when it's been photographed. People think it's like that all the time. And we did an open day recently, and it just looked like this. But it doesn't stay like this. But this idea of the window doors on the left there, they face north, and he struggled with the idea of how do you have a front door. And then in the end, he decided to make all the glass doors equal. So it's very open, but you get a lot of winter sun. It's beautifully orientated. And just this use of materials, a very simple palette of the brick. The brick is, actually, we don't really have a good picture of the brick. The brick is all sandstock, recycled brick taken from I think around Paddington. So even then it was, you know, old brick, and it's got great character. It's a very soft, beautiful colour. It's not like those nasty wire-cut bricks that they had to use on the Odette house. And it just gives the house such a simple character and personality, because the Marshalls would be the first to say it didn't have a big budget, and it was Bruce was just left to express his ideas, and it's very enduring. We haven't changed it apart from a carport, and we got Bruce to help us redo that, so it's very authentic. We're talking a bit about the regional differences in Australia and how different areas develop different styles. And this is a great, Gabriel Poole is an incredibly inventive architect. And this Gartner house is on a very, very high sloping block in Mount Tambourine. And it was very overgrown, so much so that the real estate agent recommended the owner, who was a single woman, got a goat, because they felt that that would help control some of the vegetation. She didn't get a goat. But she went to Gabriel Poole and said, I want you to do a house for me, but I have no money. And then she came back some years later when she did have money, and he developed this house for her, which is very personal. It's very private. So, she's living on her own. So you go through a garage and you cross this bridge to get to the front door. So once you're there, you're incredibly safe and secure. And then it has this sort of miraculous roofline that uses, a sort of iconic Australian material, but in this wonderful sweeping way that kind of recalls the Orient. And it's, I think it's a very beautiful execution. And in the bush, it's such a surprise. Now, this is one that not a lot of people like. I give you a warning, an advance warning. The Gottlieb House. But having met the owners, who are utterly passionate about it to this day. And if you get to the Museum of Sydney and watch the video, the way they talk about their love of this house is it's quite special. They commissioned it at the beginning of a recession, and so it has an incredible bespoke quality. Now, the neighbours thought it was a squash court and then kept coming with little suggestions of colour palettes that they might like to paint the outside. But it's one of these, when you go into, so it's got no windows to a street, it's very anonymous, it feels like a public building, they wanted to be able to have a party for 500 people, which I believe they did. All the furniture is bespoke in that Woodmarsh designed it all, because presumably in the recession they didn't have anything else to do. But it is a very beautiful, this staircase is, you go in and it's rare to get that kind of awe-inspired feeling in a private space. And they're so warm and lovely, and they wouldn't change a thing about it. So it's all about the right house for the right people. Here's another unusual expression of a personal desire. And this was designed by Ian Mackay for the photographer David Moore, who really loved camping and wanted something more permanent than a tent, but didn't want it to have the feel of he wanted something that sat lightly on the land. And I think they went through many iterations to find, the right kind of property. And it's now owned by his daughter, Lisa Moore, and she remembers, going there as a child and going up into the little loft bedrooms and listening to the adults talk. And she's got wonderful memories of what this house was like. But it was built by, and I think you can see this, someone who was a boat builder. And so there's this incredible level of craft, because when everything is that exposed, it has to be perfect. There's no, banging up a bit of ply or a bit of plasterboard and, hiding it. It's all there to be seen. And its setting is wonderful. It overlooks the water within these amazing rock formations. Now, this is a house that if the Lobster Bay house has an amazing site, this one has what the architect describes as a dud site. It's not a good site at all. It's in a suburb of Brisbane. It's flat. It's uninteresting. So he has had to work harder to create the interest through what he's done in the house. And I find Tim Hill a really fascinating, articulate, interesting architect. And At the end of the interview, I almost felt embarrassed to ask him, you know, I felt like I was asking him his star sign or his favourite colour, because I was asking him, you know, what does D stand for? And I imagined it to be something deep and esoteric. And he said that there were Italian builders working opposite, and they used to talk about the house, and they said, oh, it's the kind of thing we'd build for our donkeys. And so D came from donkey. So I'm very glad I asked that question, because it... you know, added that humour to that great seriousness, and this blend of inside and out, this seamless use of space, the way you... It's only denoted by... there are a sort of slice of pebbles as you go from outside to in, just to know that you're changing, you know, what area you're in. And he hates... And I got this word from him, the kaidalai, the kitchen, living, dining, which we all have. He abhors the kaidalai, and he says things should either be beautiful or useful. They should be in a storage cupboard, or they should be on display. He doesn't like lots of cupboards, and he thinks that living should be compartmentalised. And this house is designed... You can see the large window to the street, and people thought it was maybe a cafe or a... and he wanted it to be able to be not just a domestic residence, that it could be, you know, therapy rooms, or it just could have a life of something else, rather than just a domestic space. I learnt a lot, actually, from him, and was felt very glad to talk to him, as I did with all of them. And people often say, what is your favourite house? And I have to confess that after talking to each and every architect, I came out completely besotted, completely convinced that if ever I had a house to be built, it would be that architect, and then I'd move on to the next one. So clearly very fickle. I put this in just because everybody knows it, and it was such a groundbreaking house at the time. And, you know, there's a lot of criticism. People say that, you know, that international style, you don't pay any attention to site. It's just their argument is it should be good enough to sit anywhere, whereas the Frank Lloyd Wrightians believe that site and house need to work as one and manifest as one. But it's an exciting house all the same, and I think people would, you know, come and look, come and peek on a Saturday. They'd find lots of people, you know, looking through the foliage to you know, see this miraculous house. And the kitchen, you know, was shown in House and Garden and Home Beautiful, you know, as the last word in American huge appliances. And, you know, so I think it created a lot of excitement in a way that maybe domestic architecture hadn't had that exposure, and, you know, the wonderful furniture that was brought directly in from the States and so forth. And because people can see it, and because there are events around it, like, you know, the 50s fair and so forth, it's kind of become part of our understanding of architectural domestic life in Sydney. And in a way, this sandstone fireplace is the only nod to the natural. Everything else is, you know, has a very strongly man-made feel. But it's interesting also, I don't have it in these pictures, but, you know, space is divided with a curtain. So again, that, you know, back to Sean Godsell and his sliding walls, you know, a curtain could divide space. It didn't have to be permanent. This fluidity of space became much more of a notion to be explored. Now, this is such a beautiful house. You see, Annalisa is here, who lives in it. Hello. Hello. You can ask questions later, or answer questions even. This is the house of Russell Jack, who is such a kind of wonderful, interesting man, and so good at storytelling, and so modest, and sort of practical. You know, this house was on the south side of the street, so it didn't have to be built in brick. He had the freedom to use timber, because the regulations at that time, certain streets had to be brick, because that was, you know, what was deemed desirable. And there was a creek running through the block, so they had to be very inventive about how they built it. And they developed a kind of L-shaped house with living on one side and bedrooms on the other. And it kind of was expandable, you know, as his family changed, he'd just, you know, cover in a veranda, and had a kind of great kind of casual approach to how the space could expand. And I think he said that, you know, a dining room, it's only used a few times a day, so it can just be a corridor, you know. So it's a great kind of combination of practicality and beauty. And this is one of my favourite shots. In fact, I was very keen for the one on the left to be a cover, because it's got that, it's so Australian, and yet it's got that beautiful, quiet Japanese quality. It's just kind of quite a magical spot. If I did have to choose a favourite house, this is it. It's just extraordinary. It's kind of handcrafted modern, and it kind of came out of the architect. He never got proper registration, so he couldn't ever work properly. And so he put, I think, a lot of his energies into this house at Sugarloaf Point in Castle Crag. And it's just got this incredible wave ceiling that it's hand built, so he's, you know, steamed and shaped and installed the timber himself. All the furnishings and the fittings are made by him, and even the carpet at the back, he's customised. And subtle things like the way the glass table meets a little window in the sandstone wall. So you've got conflicting kind of materials, but coming together in beautiful ways. So there's so many things about this house that I just love. And even these strange, quirky details where, you know, the woven nature of it, and this very precarious stairwell where apparently he used to scamper down there even in his 80s. And, you know, the idea of health and safety was abhorrent to him, and he kind of, you know, had this kind of staircase that really would make people weep with anxiety, you know, down there. So that's my favourite house, and that's... it's my other favourite house. Sorry. Sorry. It was all final there and everybody was perking up, and now you've got to listen to another. Richard Laplastre is such a subtle practitioner and such a genuine, thoughtful person. And this house was done for a very special client, and it is, again, not everybody's cup of tea, because it has one wall, which is rammed earth, and the rest are sort of canvas walls or this retractable roof. And again, it's built by boat builders, so the level of craft is just phenomenal. So it's both modest and exceptional, and part of its exceptional quality comes from its set in Bulgola, in a sort of grove of ancient palms. So everything was sort of magical right from the very beginning. And, you know, I said to the owner, well, you know, what about it being cold and drafty and all these kind of things? And he goes, I have never looked for the lack in the building. I've only ever, you know, seen the beauty. And all emotional. So that's why I love those two houses, because they're one-offs, they're unrepeatable, they're kind of a bit eccentric, but so joyful and connected to nature. And there's just a couple more. That's the entrance, which again you can see this great influence of Japan. And you know, you come in along here, and then you're exposed to this huge retractable roof that connects with nature, and lots of water dragons everywhere, and it just is. It's like nowhere on earth, to be honest. Audience Q&A, over to you.
Well, many thanks. Right on time. So, Janet Grundy's got copies of Karen McCartney's 50, 60, 70 Iconic Australian Houses, and the hardback book 70, 80, 90 Iconic Australian Houses. I'm very pleased. And Alicia's here, because looking at those houses, I'm sure no one lived in any of them. But you do. And you've got some books. And an ashtray, is it? Or a tape recorder. What was on the table? What was on the table? There was something on the table in front of the bookcase.
Oh, I missed it.
Yeah. I noticed.
You're very observant.
Well, it was all there was in all the houses. The only thing, only sign of human habitation. Thanks for, and I'm sure the author will be happy to sign copies of the book after. So I'll just lead off. As you mentioned, your background's Belfast, which, as you know, is a kind of 19th century industrial British city. So you came out here and you show an interest in this post-World War II Australian architecture. What led you to that kind of interest? Just come back here.
I will indeed. I just had a baby. And I thought I had more time in my hand. You know, your mind kind of in between all that sort of caring bit. And I love an idea. And I think, you know, I was a magazine editor. And so my friend, who's the photographer of these two books, said, oh, Murdoch Books are looking for ideas. So I kind of, you know, rattled off my idea. And I was very passionate about it, because I'd learnt a lot through living in the house, and Bruce Rickard hated public speaking, so he'd get his clients in to speak on his behalf. So I began to have to articulate what it was I liked about living in this house. So part of that process started that interest and started me thinking about it. And so we did this proposal, and I didn't really expect it to happen. And so when it did, as I said at the beginning, you know, then I had to start and find the houses, and there were lots of disappointments along the way, because I wanted to marry a significant architect with a significant house, logically enough. But that wasn't always easy, and so I'd set my sights on someone, and then I'd go and see the house, and it was so disappointing. But you'd talk to the people, and then you'd have to kind of backpedal, and you know. So it's not a, if you just used images that existed, you could have done it in a heartbeat. But the whole point was to capture them as they are. Well, you know, the first book in 2006, as they are essentially today, and then. So the first book was hard, and I was working full-time at News Limited, and then the second book was a much easier one, because the architects were all alive. I had a book that I could send them and go, it will be like this. And so that was more a process of choosing the right things. And, you know, the iconic kind of tag, I think, takes time. And so I didn't want to get too... I felt very nervous about making choices that were too close to the present. But I feel, you know, John Wardell, who's the last architect in the second book, has gone on to win, you know, the Robin Boyd Prize for this year with his current house. And so you kind of want to pick winners, because it's kind of important, if you're going to use that term, that it's genuinely applied.
Before we go just to the next question, I should have mentioned you've got this exhibition on at the, it's up the road there at the Museum of Sydney, so just tell us a little bit about that.
I mentioned earlier the Glenn Murcutt Masterclasses, and they're organised by an architect who's also from Northern Ireland called Lindsay Johnson. And Lindsay contacted me and said, can I sell some of your books at the Masterclasses, because all of the architects present there have a house in the book. So he lives up the river, up the Hawkesbury, and so I left them all wrapped up in plastic bags and so forth for him to collect at Brooklyn Marina. And so then we got to know each other, and he had done a successful exhibition with the Glenn Murcutt. And so he said, why don't I propose to the Museum of Sydney an exhibition around your books? Good, yeah, that sounds good. And so we did that, and then we began to, you know, develop the ideas. We've now got funding for it to travel, so it will go around Australia, so I'm very proud of that. And the experience then of how do you tell a different story than the books tell, so that people don't come and just go, oh, well, I could have just looked at a book. So we did videos, we got models made, and we've got iPad content. So we kind of tried to add richer layers for people who might know the books, and to think about the content in themes rather than in chronology. So that kind of, it does feel interesting as a, it's not a big exhibition, so you can get, you know, in 45 minutes you can get a really good sense of it. And interviewing the architects, capturing their words while they're all still around, to me was incredibly important, because these people are hugely significant, and yeah, the video really is fantastic. It's great to listen to their words very directly.
There's a question here. Just stay in front of the microphone.
Okay. Well, when you use the word iconic, do you mean something that's quintessentially Australian, or something that's a trendsetter, or something that's unique on its own?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, sort of all of the above, because I felt that you needed to choose something that broke new ground, and I didn't really worry about its Australianness, because I think actually these architects are world class. So I kind of just looked for something that, were they moving the visual language of architecture on in some way? And was it beautiful? And was the experience, you know, I visited all of these houses, so was the experience of being in them something? Did you get a feeling? You know, there's this, it needs to be human scale, and it needs to, I mean, a lot of these houses are not big houses. There are a few in the second book that are, mostly they're quite modest. And so it's about ideas and concepts over, you know, money spent?
There's a question down there that we're coming up with.
The selection you showed us was great, but it seemed entirely sexist. Do you have any comments on...
Oh, you mean no women?
Well, I missed them.
No, you didn't miss them. You know what? I have in, Britt Anderson is in the next book, and Durbach Block, with Camilla Block. I just didn't want to, I wanted to choose what I could thought was the best, and that's what I've done. And I, in other books that I've done, I'm conscious of that, but I need to make sure that I'm not doing it to be condescending, and I've never done that. Because to me, you need to get really excited by what you see. And if you overlay it with other things, like is it Australian enough? Is it by a female architect? I think it kind of loses some of its power. And obviously, in the first book, that was a period where architecture was dominated by men, and it's changing. And I've just done another book, which is has a lot more women in it.
Karen, I love the range that you've shown us, and I'm interested in materials. And until you started speaking, I thought a brick was a brick was a brick. And now we've got wire-cut bricks and other bricks, and your house has got recycled bricks. Do we have brick manufacturers or makers that are regional and therefore reflect the sort of character of the areas that they come from? And are we beginning to recycle those bricks and preserve them and make use of them?
I think, you know, brick, it sort of became in the 70s sort of ubiquitous and everybody kind of turned off it a bit. But I think that the manufacturers are beginning to engage architects in how it can be used and how it can be beautiful again. And it's like anything that becomes, it's become unfashionable. But again, I feel that this kind of, you know, fashion for just rendering everything has become ubiquitous and is boring. And you can see that, I guess, industries need to go, oh, actually, we had a good run there, and now we need to put some more energy into it, and we need to engage new thinking, and we need to make it exciting again, make it relevant. Because it's a great material.
Push it down the back.
I'm just interested in having you having spent time looking at these iconic buildings. Whether you see, and I'm not talking about McMansions here,
yes.
Whether you see the influence of those buildings in more commonly built houses in the suburbs.
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, the opening up of space and that desire, you know, even if you live in a terrace, there's that desire to open up the back to get more light in and to create connections between inside and out. I think that's really significant, and that was pioneered by these architects. And also the coming down of it, internal walls, you know, the idea that the kitchen was contained and the dining was contained and so forth, that is now what people desire, is a much more open plan style of living, that's much more you know, communal. And you know, we have in our house, there is one main living room. There isn't a media room for kids to go to or be separate. You have to learn to negotiate, you know, between FIFA and, you know, TV and, you know. So I often wonder, is there a sort of optimum size for family life where there's enough space, but also there's enough interaction to learn how to deal with different things. But, you know, the floor plan of houses has increased enormously. Our house is about 160 square metres, and, you know, I think the average is something like 240 these days, more maybe.
So you've spoken about space, but what about noise? There must be problems with noise in these houses, mustn't there?
It's never occurred to me. Noise. There's no problem with noise in... I mean, our house is essentially timber. You're thinking more of the concrete spaces where
well,
it might be echoey.
I'm thinking of noise with the lack of walls and whether you hear everyone else throughout the house.
No, it's never actually... But maybe it's just what you're used to. You know, maybe if you have, you know, walls and you're used to a kind of more private, quiet, that's one thing. But I guess... yeah, maybe that's what Robin Boyd was doing, putting the kids down the end of the living space.
So we go one, two, yep, down three, yeah. Okay.
with the bricks, there's a thing about weathering. What people want to do is an opportunity to compare these photographs with the original publication photographs. So it's really interesting to look at the 90s houses that are weathering quite a lot and looking good. What would your comment be, having seen all that? Like, you're probably the only person who's seen all of these houses in this period of time. How are things weathering? What materials go well?
It's interesting. The Gottlieb House that we all said was like a squash court. You know, it's weathering. Concrete weathers. You know, it gets marks. But they embrace all that. And I think this isn't really answering your question, but it's another important point, which is good clients get good houses. And there's this sense of all the people I talk to, they kind of, it's not that they were easy clients, but they trusted the process and they let something happen that maybe was a bit challenging for them and maybe something that took them out of their comfort zone. But time has been the factor that has said, actually, that is a really great space. And they've stayed in them. They haven't moved. So I guess, look, all houses need maintenance and you need to care for them. But I think that, as you say, brick is a pretty robust material. I don't know if I've really answered your question. I'm floundering slightly, but it's only because I'm not super technical. But I didn't see any houses that maybe I wouldn't have chosen to photograph and that didn't look in good condition.
Yeah, that was. Just speak up a bit.
When you started to select your examples for the book, what did you start with?
So what was your selection process?
Yes.
What did you start with?
I started with a handful that I knew. I mean, our house, I knew I could get that. But there were maybe only three that I really knew. And so I had to, then I started with the architects. So I did the research, found the architects that I thought were important and interesting, and then tried to find a house from that point. But then there were things like that wonderful glass house in Castle Crag. So I tracked down the owners who were living abroad and so forth. But it is literally a glass cube, and it was rented. And so the people who rented had lots of stuff. So you can't look into a glass house that sort of has lots of stuff. So things fell through that I would have loved to have done and I felt were important. So as I say, there were lots of disappointments. And then when you got it and it all came together, it was so exciting.
Yes, Chris.
In the 1950s, I was a marketing executive in the building industry. And it was James Hardie's manufacturing, who were the big manufacturers of asbestos sheeting. We got rid of the asbestos, but we still had the asbestos sheeting, cement sheeting. And materials are most important in a house. In Melbourne, for instance, over 90% of the houses in Victoria use brick. And that's an enormous number of houses. And the use of brick doesn't give you the opportunity to do the type of designs and things like that that you've mentioned. In fact, most of it is only in a very small part of the market that you can do with Judith. How about mass housing? What do you see as a future in mass housing?
Well, I guess, you know, at this period there was, you know, Ken Woolley and Michael Dysart, you know, looking at project homes, which were, you know, quite incredible. And then you also had the Age Small Houses Service in Melbourne, where Robin Boyd and later Neil Clarahan worked on, you know, you could get a plan and have it modified. And so there was that kind of populist access to cheaper housing. And that just, you know, I've looked quite a lot into the whole idea of prefab. It just never can seem to gain traction. And it's a shame, because you've got all the cleverness of the architectural thinking, and if you can mass produce the components, then it sort of makes sense that you can have a cheaper house. But the public don't seem to take it up. And I do think there are lessons to be learned from these houses around siting, and so that everything doesn't need to be constantly air conditioned. But to a degree, you're right, these are the exceptional. and rather than the broad mass housing. But I think if developers choose to take lessons out of them, there are quite simple things that could be done, but I know it all comes down to cost in the end.
Robin, and then Robin.
The books overlap in the 70s.
They do.
Is this for continuity, or is this because there were so many interesting examples from the 70s that it was a period of a lot of activity that meant you had lots of material to choose from?
The latter. We initially talked about doing the logical thing, which was 80s, 90s and noughties. But I felt it was getting too close. And then the two houses, I had tried to get the Palm House in my first book, and the owner had said no, because it was very private. But by the time I came to the second book, he was prepared to say yes. And the Glen Market House. So I thought, I've got two such significant examples here, and I felt that it would be wrong not to do it, and again, that uncomfortableness was just getting a bit too close to the present day, and for those two reasons. And, you know, we had a bit of, you know, discussion with the publishing company about how that would roll, but I'm glad we stuck to our guns and did that.
Yes.
So these are iconic houses because you've chosen them, but they're also houses that are unique and have a kind of heritage to them. Is there, the owners of the house are just owners of a house. What happens to these sorts of houses if the people who buy them don't particularly treasure them and regard themselves as custodians? I mean, is there...
They're very vulnerable. They are very vulnerable. I mean, when we went to the open day to the Marshall House, you know, people were walking around and they were saying, well, obviously you'd make a picture window there, you'd knock that down. Seriously. And you would be as hot as, you know, because it faces west. So there's a reason why things are done. Oh, we'd paint all the bricks white and we'd, you know, so, you know, and people want to feel that their pets paying a lot of money for something, they want to feel that they have a choice. But you do need to, as a culture, decide what matters and protect what matters, because there are some really beautiful houses that have been knocked over because they're often lightweight and on a great site that as values, property value, or land values rise, they become vulnerable.
Okay, so go ahead.
There was a house in South Taramara, I think they put a heritage listing on, because someone wanted to add a, I can't remember, is there much activity in that area where they're looking at these iconic houses and actually the heritage push towards retaining and say
I think
they are rather than allowing
It
is. And it's. I think part of the problem is that even if houses are donated, they need to come with a kind of almost like a maintenance fund, because the cost of actually looking after them... So that's quite a hard thing if somebody gives you the house, but actually where's the money to keep it for the next, you know, 20 years? So I think a lot of really good places sort of slip below that kind of... that super standard, and they just, you know, as we were saying, just become vulnerable.
Thank you.
Yes. sorry, I've just.
Sure,
don't worry.
So we're getting to the end. Have I missed anyone?
Oh, yes, okay. I know. Most of the houses that you showed us were enhanced by their settings, and the truth probably is that they wouldn't have built them in some unsuitable or inappropriate location. For instance, you wouldn't see those houses in a housing estate, so they'd have to be on a specific site. No doubt architects can, get rid of unsightly views in some way or other in the design of the house. But, yes, they'd have to be built separately. There doesn't seem to be any mass movement towards building that sort of house, even on a smaller scale,
Mass housing, yes. And I think it's that thing of if people would choose to, there are principles that you could take and adapt, because these are all, you know, pretty rarefied. That's what makes them, you know, they're kind of an art form, so that's what makes them special. But I think if you cared to put the thinking in, there are things that could be done, quite simple things that actually would address some of those issues. But what does make these beautiful, you're right, is the context and the landscape, and that is very Australian and very, you know, when it works well, it's quite magical.
So is it
Yes, I've got a big glass window and a marvellous tree outside, but people have told me that it's called the glebe weed. It's all over glebe, this tree. I think it's hackberry, and it probably originally came from China, then went to Italy and then came to Australia. But I've been told that nowadays you can only plant native trees in glebe, and the great feature for this tree is you get plenty of shade in summer, and you can see things in the winter.
It's an iconic tree,
exactly. Yes. I'd just ignore them. Keep your beautiful iconic tree.
Finally, what are you up to next? I mean, you're going to take your show on the road around Australia.
Yes.
But apart from that, I mean, what's the next writing project?
I've got another book that's coming out in October. And it's publishers these days want books that have an international appeal. So the houses in this book are from all over the world. I've got 4 Australian, 1 New Zealand, and then the rest are, you know, North and South America and Europe and so forth. So it takes not a dissimilar principle, but it's houses that are beyond the everyday. They're exceptional in some way. So it goes from like a little pea green prefab house to an English castle that was a ruin that's been stitched together and modernised in the most sensitive of ways. It won the Sterling Prize, actually, in the UK. So this kind of range of houses, I wanted to be that you turn the pages and every house has a different reason for being super. So it might be the site or the concept or the materials or, you know, it just has something special about it. And it features quite a lot of buildings that are reused. So I've got Ricardo Bofill reclaimed a cement factory in the 70s outside Barcelona. So I've got this kind of, you know, marvellous, weird, strange place. And then I've got a little cottage in Ballarat. So it's that push and pull of size and scale and ideas. So that's the next one.
Many thanks. So thanks to Karen McCartney for a stimulating and informative presentation at the Sydney Institute tonight. We've got, Janet Grundy's got some copies of Karen's books, or her 2 books here, and there's more to come, so no doubt we'll have you back again in the future. But for tonight, thanks for a stimulating talk. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.